Miss your favourite show? Then listen online at the RN website.
G'day, I'm Michael Cathcart, and you're so very welcome to Books and Arts Daily here on RN. Today you're going on a visit to the underworld for a really sparkling version of the story of Orpheus and Eurydice. And you'll have a chance encounter with the Aboriginal actor Tom E. Lewis at the very same airport, which changed the course of his life.
A blonde guy got up and I've gone, what did I do wrong to these people, you know? And next to Rhonda was standing next to me. Hello, my name's Rhonda Skepsey and we would like you to act in our movie.
Isn't that a great story? More of that a bit later on. And we head back to the vinyl frontier with sound librarians Munson and Lee. This week they've been exploring music like this, Asian pop music from the 1970s. But first, one of the iconic Australian sounds from 1981. Chrissy Amphlett and the Divinyls belting it out, yes, in 1981 with the Boys in Town. Chrissy Amphlett died from breast cancer last year in April, and now our First Lady of Rock will have a Melbourne laneway named in her honour. It will be called Amphlett Lane. The Melbourne City Council have approved the laneway name change. They did that just last week, and Jenny Valentich has been part of the Amphlett Lane campaign from the very start. She's the editor of Time Out Melbourne, and she's sitting right in front of me. She's also a novelist. Good morning and welcome.
Morning.
Congratulations. You've got this up.
Oh, it's so fantastic. It's been over a year in the making, but we've had the full support from Melbourne City Council. I really do have to credit them. They've been kind of urging us along all the way, and in the meeting last week, the Lord Mayor came up and gave us his support. And also, Councillor Rowan Leppert from the start has just been helping us along every step of the way.
So we've got people all over Australia listening, all over the world online. They can go onto Google Maps, I guess, and find this lane. How would we do that? Where is it?
Right, it's off Little Bourke Street, and it's right, if you go to the Princess Theatre on Spring Street and then down Little Bourke, you'll see it sort of nestled between two restaurants, and it goes right up to the stage door of the Palace Theatre.
So they're in an L shape, there are two theatres. There's the Princess Theatre, the old, beautiful old 19th century theatre, and then there's the Palace Theatre.
That's right. The Palace, which is known to some as the Metro. It's had many name changes over the years. But the relevance is that the Divinyls played the Palace. And also the Princess was where Chrissy had a run as Judy Garland in The Boy from Oz. And also she signed her marriage certificate in there as well with Charlie Drayton.
Right. So it's an absolutely key location for her. So why do this? Why do you want to do this?
We just think that it's a real shame that Australian music heritage can really get lost, and a laneway is a great way of preserving it, and Melbourne does it so well. You know, you've got AC/DC Lane. On the non-music front, you've got the Dame Edna Lane, you've got Paul Hester Walk, you've got Roland S. Howard Lane coming up. And it's a great way to commemorate Chrissy in an area that she really loved.
Let me put the other case to you, because some of these lanes are pretty scungy, actually, and some of them don't even have names at the moment. They've got numbers or they're called something everyone forgets. And really, you know, to be cruel about them, they are sort of a drainway where people keep rubbish bins. Perhaps it's not such a noble place to be commemorated.
But they're so Melbourne. I mean, if you ask a tourist what they think of about Melbourne, they're going to say the laneways.
Yeah, but
it's the feature that we talk about.
But they think of the lovely laneways in which there are little coffee shops and walkways. Yeah. These are pretty kind of functional.
Okay,
areas,
well, let me hand that over to something Patricia Amphlett said, who's, of course, Chrissy's cousin, Little Patty. And she was saying, you know, there are some really fine laneways around here which are very la-di-da, and part of Chrissy would enjoy that because she liked the really posh shops down Collins Street. But at the same time, she's a rock and roll chick, and she'd want somewhere that was rock and roll. And if you look at what AC/DC Lane have done and what Cherry Bar have done with that lane, they've made it, you know, covered with rock posters and murals. Then you've got Hosier Lane, who've actually made a feature of their bins and they've turned that into artwork. So what we really need to do is get a great mural or two and make it a fitting rock and roll tribute to Chrissie.
So it's an unexpected corner of the city. You come down this corner and there it is, it all jumps at you, comes to life.
Yeah, I mean, you'd be going to the sort of genteel area, the theatre district, and there it is.
Yes, screaming at you. This is Chrissie Amphlett. Now, well, it's not called Chrissie Amphlett Lane. Why don't we call it Chrissie Amphlett Lane?
Yeah, that's right. It's called Amphlett Lane because as of 2010, there was a change of policy that you can only have a single name for a laneway after complaints from Australia Post and also the emergency services. Apparently, it's much easier to find something with a single name. I don't know if that's going to get overturned in the future. I know Roland S. Howard Lane team are trying to get that overthrown. But from our point of view, you know, you've also got Patricia Amphlett, who's a legendary Amphlett in this country. Yeah. So we're going to have a plaque or two up which explains exactly what the lane is.
Isn't that an extraordinary rule? I mean, with the greatest of respect to the emergency services, it does seem extraordinary that they can't find a street that's got two names instead of one.
Maybe there's more to it than that.
Maybe there is, I guess. So what was involved in campaigning for this? You just didn't walk into the front door of the Melbourne City Council and say, I've got a great idea, and they say, thank you, Jeannie, for coming in. It's been brilliant. What happened?
No, it was started by author, astrologer and journalist Jessica Adams in July last year, and she started a petition. And we got over 7,000 names of people, of fans, wanting a laneway to commemorate Chrissie in Melbourne. Including lots of MS sufferers because Chrissie suffered from MS. So we needed somewhere that was very accessible. And we presented that to Melbourne City Council along with Charlie Drayton, who's Chrissie's husband, and he's the drummer in Cold Chisel, amongst other bands, and Patricia Amphlett. And then it was a very long process. First it had to get approved, and then we had to wait for Charlie to come over from the States and do lots of proper lane shopping, if you like, window shopping for lanes, to find somewhere.
Oh, you went on a lane cruise.
We went on many lane cruises. There are many, many lanes out there that are up for grabs. I don't know if I should say that, but they're called corporation lanes. If something's a corporation lane, then it's possible that it can be renamed.
Okay.
And they're all over the city. And then last week it was tabled at a council meeting to get the actual location approved, which it was unanimously, and there's a great atmosphere in the room and all the councillors were really game for it.
Okay. The Lentish Lane's got a nice ring.
It does, doesn't it?
Now, very quickly, you're on the board of the Australian Music Museum Project. This is another campaign you're on. What's that about?
Oh, such a campaigner. It's actually springboarded from the Amphlett Lane campaign. We were talking to a lot of musicians and industry people and politicians, and everyone was lamenting the same thing, that Australia doesn't have a national music museum. There have been many attempts in the past by people lobbying for one. So what we thought we'd do is we'd put up a website, amp.tv, AMP.TV, and we'd commemorate. Well, we'd register all the attempts in the past and our attempts now to lobby for a national museum. And we're also doing a digital museum to show what it could look like. So we're asking fans to send in pictures of all their memorabilia. You know, it might be them cuddling somebody outside the Countdown Studios, might be a guitar pick that they caught. Send a photo of it. We'll put up a digital museum. We've already started. We've already got the Chrissie Amphlett famous neon mic stand. And once we've got a massive museum of memorabilia, it should be easier to lobby for a real thing.
You'll need a building.
Yes, we do.
More than a lane, you'll need a whole building. Oh, well, best of luck with that. Keep us posted. And thank you for coming in today.
Thank you.
Good on you. Jeannie Valentish. She's the editor of Time Out Melbourne. She's a novelist. Her book is called Cherry Bomb. It's about the rock music industry. And if you want to find out more about the Australian Music Museum Project and about Amphlett Lane, there are links there on our website. And here's just a little note. Most of us got to know that song, Boys in Town, from the 1982 film Monkey Grip, which was written by the young Helen Garner, whose latest book about the Farquharson murder is just out. See, everything's connected to everything else.
I've read that book. It's great.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? The linkages across the universe are staggering. This is Books and Arts Daily on RN. I'm Michael Cathcart. And next stop is the underworld. specially commissioned for a contemporary version of the ancient Greek love story of Orpheus and Eurydice. Now, this really vibrant play is just called Eurydice. It's by the New York playwright Sarah Rule, and it's playing at Melbourne's Red Stitch Actors Theatre. In the original version of the story, Eurydice and Orpheus fall in love and they marry, but she is stung by a viper and dies shortly afterwards. And the grieving Orpheus makes a daring journey to the underworld to rescue her. He's armed only with a musical instrument, his famous lyre, and when he plays it, he can charm the most monstrous of foes, and indeed Hades, the god of the underworld, is duly charmed, and he allows Orpheus to return to the world with Eurydice, but there is a condition. On the journey home, she must walk behind him. He must not look back. So how is this new version different? And what does it add to the old Greek myth? Joining me to talk about this are Luke Kerridge, who is the director of the show.
Good morning.
Jonathan Peck, who plays Orpheus. Hi, John.
Hey, how you doing?
And Nairi Dawn Fair, who is lovely as Eurydice.
Hello.
Welcome to the program. Now, in most treatments of this story, and there have been lots of them, there have been operas and ballets and movies, all sorts of things, it's really the travails of Orpheus that are at the top of the list, and she's the kind of love interest. But this play, Luke, really does turn the focus of the story somewhat.
That's right. We kind of, you know, after being one of the potentially older stories in the world, we get the other side of the story, which is that of Eurydice. And Sarah Rule had her own particular reasons for beginning to focus on Eurydice and reasons for returning to the myth.
Why was that?
So as a young person, I think she was about 21 at the time, she lost her father. And she was more interested in poetry at the time, but was just starting to become a playwright and wrote the play as a kind of ritual for dealing with her grief. Rather than have her grief pathologized, she thought she'd write a play about it.
I'll just get you to move off that mic just a tad. Yeah. She said it was a way of sort of keeping in touch with him.
That's right. And so the play was really a way of her continuing her conversations with her father. And so that's her big addition to the myth, is what her question was, what would have happened for Eurydice when she went into the underworld? And in this play, we get to see who she got
runs
to meet.
She runs into the old man.
Yeah, that's right.
He's a bit of a scallywag, Nairi, isn't he?
In the play and in real life.
Yes, that's true. So tell us about your father.
Well, it's interesting because Alex is Russian, which I really love. His accent brings a whole new quality to the play that would never be in any other production.
So Alex Minglet plays
Alex
the father.
Minglet, yeah. And, you know, because the play is... Sarah Rule's American, and she grew up in Illinois, so there's references, a lot of American references. And so just him having the accent and our accent, and then Olya, who plays one of the stones, is a chorus of stones. It brings a kind of universal feel to the play that I really love. Yeah.
It's a really lovely idea that she goes to the underworld and there's her old dad who hasn't succumbed to the underworld. So the thing about the underworld is that if you wash in the river there, you just forget everything, you lose language, you live in a kind of perpetual limbo, really. But he hasn't done that. He's a bit of a rebel.
He's the only one who can still speak and read and write. He sort of held on to some clues. And so, you know, the play is also about memory because he has to teach Eurydice. She doesn't recognise him and he has to teach her language again and how to speak. And
so where does this leave the boyfriend? Jonathan?
Where does this leave poor old Orpheus? Well, it leaves him in the real world sort of trying his hardest to get down to her the same way as he always has. But I suppose once we get down there, Eurydice's got a bit of a choice to make, where she's re-established this relationship with her father, and then, but she's also got potentially, you know, her love that's come down to get her, and so she actually has to make that decision. What happens? I'll leave a bit of a mystery.
So you're going to do a scene for us. Did you decide which scene to do?
Yes.
What have you decided to do?
We timed what we're doing, and we think it's going to.
You think it'll work?
Well.
It'll fit into our parameters.
Yes. We'll just do it really, really quickly. Yeah.
Okay. What scene is it?
It's just to give you a little bit of backstory. Eurydice is able to sort of reflect on her relationship with Orpheus once after death. She's able to better reflect upon it. So, and she's talking about the differences, the difficulties of loving an artist to her father. So she's talking to her father in the scene, and Orpheus, meanwhile, is up in the upper world figuring out a way to get to her.
All right, take it away.
Thank you. Orpheus never liked words. He had his music. He would get a funny look on his face and I would say, "What are you thinking about?" And he was always thinking about music. If we were in a restaurant, sometimes he would look sullen and wouldn't talk to me, and I thought people felt sorry for me. I should have realized women envied me. Their husbands talked too much. But I wanted to tell him about my notions. I was working on a new philosophical system. It involved hats. This is what it is to love an artist. The moon is always rising above your house. The houses of your neighbors look dull and lacking in moonlight. But he is always going away from you. Inside his head, there is always something more beautiful. Orpheus said, "The mind is a slide ruler. It can fit around anything. Words can mean anything." "Show me your body," he said. "It only means one thing."
Eurydice, before I go down there, I won't practice my music. Some say practice, but practice is a word invented by cowards. The animals don't have a word for practice. A gazelle doesn't run for practice. He runs because he's hungry or because he is scared. A bird doesn't sing for practice. She sings because she's happy or because she's sad. So I say, store it up. The music sounds better in my head than it does in the world. When songs are pressing against my throat, then, only then, I will go down and I will sing for the devils and they will cry through their parched throats. Eurydice, don't kiss a dead man. Their lips, they may look red and tempting, but you put your tongue in their mouths and it tastes like oatmeal. I know how much you hate oatmeal. Here's my plan. Tonight, when I go to bed, I'll turn off the light and put a straw in my mouth. When I fall asleep, I'll crawl through the straw and my breath will push me like a great wind into the darkness and I will sing your name and I will arrive. I've consulted the footstools, the almanacs, the architects, everyone agrees. I've found the right note. Wait for me. Love, Orpheus.
Yeah, what a lovely, lovely exchange. John Peck as Orpheus and Nairi Dawn Fair as Eurydice. And we're talking about the production of Eurydice that's currently playing at Red Stitch Theatre in Melbourne, directed by Luke Kerridge. She really faces a choice, doesn't she, Luke, between returning the land of the living or staying there with her dad?
That's right. And I think so her re-meeting her father, in a sense, we get the feeling in the early parts of the play, she hasn't really had a chance to let him go just yet. So I think really the play, what it's exploring is how we do let people go when they die. And there's a bit of a story in this too. Orpheus and Eurydice are depicted as quite young, very much in love. And it's also, you know, the arc Eurydice's travelling is about growing up and how we start to leave our parents behind or leave our memories.
But she's not really ready to leave the old man, is
no,
she?
No, that's right. Yeah, it gets her into all sorts of trouble.
Yeah, it's kind of choosing between, you know, living as a grown-up or, you know, staying with your father. And that's a choice that a lot of people have to make in life. You know, a lot of us don't ever feel like grown-ups.
And the play, surprisingly, has some quite funny moments. I mean, in that even that line you just did, John, about the don't kiss dead people, they taste like oatmeal. I mean, we laughed the night I was there. I laughed anyway. I think others were laughing around me.
Thank God you were there.
Or you could have said, so you were the guy who ruined my
night. That gets a good laugh every night, oatmeal line.
So surprisingly, it's a funny play.
It has to be peppered with humour because, I mean, a lot of the content that it's dealing with is sort of, you know, about loss and grief. And so there's some fantastic additions to the script and by the cast and from the director to sort of reintroduce humour into this show. So it can be really, really light in a whole lot of different ways.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of what Sarah Rule's trying to get at, is that that's the way to deal with grief, really, is to, you have to look at it with a smile at times, otherwise you know, you won't get through it.
When I came out of the show, I tweeted that it didn't have dramatic weight. What it had was a kind of fairy story, I can't exactly
charm.
Fairy story charm, yeah. And at that stage, I was unsure whether that was a criticism or not, whether I wanted the show to be more momentous in its dealing of life and death, or whether I was really happy with the fact that it was such a fairy tale, because it's totally enjoyable. It's 75 minutes of a completely enjoyable theatre, and as you know, if a play's no good, 75 minutes is an eternity in the theatre. I don't know what it is about theatre, but you can put up with crap television for hours on end, but a lousy play, you're just screaming with pain in the theatre.
Because you have to give back. It's an energetic
exchange.
Is that
what it is?
I think so. It gets into your body much more than
screaming, get me out of here.
Yeah. You can't make noise. You can't get up and scream and walk out. Open a bag of chips.
That's it. I suppose that's it. You can't go to the fridge.
No.
But it is interesting. I had a family member who has recently lost her father, and it had a profound impact on her. So it depends where you're at, I think, emotionally, and how
were
the subject matter affects you.
Were you about that person being in the audience and seeing this?
I was a little bit. Yeah, I was. But at the same time, you know, thank goodness that she deals with it with such a light touch, so that, you know, so that people can come out and have a different experience and everyone can take what they want from it.
Mm. I was a bit frustrated that you weren't in a bigger theatre.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I wanted lots of people to see the show. Mm. I felt that last time I went to Red Stitch, Grounded, I saw the play Grounded. I thought, this should be in a major theatre. Did you ever feel that? Do you sit there thinking, about yourselves. Yeah. We know we're here doing great work and we're in this tiny little theatre.
We have a nice five-week run, which is it's kind of unusual for you know, the smaller theatre.
Are you making a living doing this? Can I ask you that?
No.
Right. You mean I can't ask you, or you're not?
No. Well, I mean, does anybody in theatre?
Well, you should.
Yeah.
If you're at the top of your game, you shouldn't be saying it's okay, because this is as good as it gets. And that's what I'm frustrated by. I think, okay, Red Stitch is a fantastic theatre company. It takes risks. Some things work, some things don't. But I always know I'm going to see people pushing theatre to the edge, trying something new. I also know that often I will see interesting American plays that, you know, I may not see elsewhere, and this is a very interesting play. So I was sort of frustrated on your behalf.
Mm. We're really pushing, Red Stitch as a company is really pushing, with Ella as our artistic director, Ella Caldwell, really pushing to increase artists' wages and, you know, and creatives. It's a slow, you know, baby steps.
Yeah,
baby steps. We're aiming for that.
Nuts. There, I've said it. It's nuts.
There is something really beautiful, though. I mean, to have to stage a play like this in a small space like that was the first thing I had to deal with, I think, with directing this, because it could be, as you say, it could be quite epic, and it's dealing with big themes. And there's something quite beautiful, I think, about that space that just puts all the focus onto the actors. You know, that's kind of all.
Oh, it's a lovely space. So I'm not frustrated by the intimacy and the way in which you've created the underworld in this beautiful intimate space is very powerful. Mm. And the set design is just genius.
Yeah. Emily Collet is a genius set designer. Yeah, it's beautiful.
So you've got lots of water in the space.
Yes.
Which always upsets the lighting people, because electricity and water are kind of a terrible combination, really.
And the actors.
Very excited by it, actually.
Is that right?
A bit too excited.
Well, that's Now, this play, Luke, is studied as part of the Year 12 curriculum. Is that right?
That's right, yes. Yeah, so we've had a fair amount of school groups coming through. In fact, the first 2 weeks are almost sold out just with schools, which is wonderful. I think if I saw a play like this when I was 18, it would have just – it's so theatrical and so much fun and so bold.
But it's like a film.
There's
one girl in the audience, Luke, was sitting behind her, and she said, it's like a film.
And that means it's really good, doesn't it?
I think it means it's really good, but it must be the most unfilmable play I've ever worked on, I think.
But I think she's talking about the fact that sometimes some scenes are just moments. You know, they just get these snippets that are almost moments, which is very filmic.
Maybe she was just saying you're really good.
Yeah,
you know, it's like
it's
seeing
awesome.
Really good people in the cinema instead of people who can't get a gig on film, you know, making do with theatre as if that's the sort of second-rate art form, which I guess is how some people must think of it.
Totally,
yes.
I don't know, do they? I just made that up, but perhaps they do. What do we know about Sarah Rule? Who is she?
American playwright, as you mentioned, began her life as a poet and wrote her first play called Dog Play, which was about losing her father, and it was from the perspective of the family dog waiting for the family to come home from the funeral. And I think it was at that point her her lecturer at her university thought she was something quite special. And so Eurydice is actually one of her earlier plays, and then she's gone on to have some quite big plays that have been big successes around.
So she's now a mature artist. She's 40, living
she
in New
is,
York.
Yes.
And she had a big success with the Vibrator play, didn't
That's
she?
Right,
which was performed at the Sydney Theatre Company, at the Melbourne Theatre Company. When would that have been? 2011, I reckon that was.
Okay. And this is her sort of territory, you know, the more fantastical and definitely theatrical. She often breaks the fourth wall. So she's very much a theatre animal.
That means you talk to the audience.
That means you talk straight to them,
Breaking the fourth wall is just theatre talk for you talk to me.
You she talk does to things customers. you can only do in theatre.
Yeah.
So she uses it to her full advantage. Mm.
One of the interesting twists in this play is the figure that's called Hades in the original story, the Lord of the Underworld, who in this story is played not as a fearsome god, but as a sort of petulant child. You just want to slap him. And I think that's what takes away the tragic dimension and turns it into a fairy story. What do you think that is about? Because you could have made the god of the underworld a far more fearsome and threatening character. I mean, you just think, well, you're no problem. I'll just slap you and run back to the earth, back to the surface. What's that about, do you think?
Some people are horrified by him, though.
But it's an artistic decision.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, look, I think it ties into the idea of growing up, and I think there's intentionally a kind of a fairy tale aspect around it. The play's littered with references to Alice in Wonderland, which is another girl that's fallen down and is having adventures underground. And I think it's just part of the whole experience of being a child down there and having to grow up and come back to the upper world. That's sort of the arc. So I think, you know, the child running at the stones sort of that are the chorus down there have their own sort of childish element to them too.
We didn't talk about the chorus of stones, but there is a lovely chorus of actors who just play stones, who just want it to be quiet. Shush, you can't talk in the underworld. Please stop talking. We'd like it to be quiet down here.
Yeah.
And that's an absolute genius touch, the chorus of stones. Well, thank you to all three of you for coming. Congratulations on the
thank
show,
you.
And I hope it continues to do very well for you.
Thank you very
Thanks
much.
Very much.
Thanks, mate.
Luke Kerridge, Nairi Dawn Fair, and Jonathan Peck. And Eurydice is on at Red Stitch Actors Theatre. It's in Chapel Street in Melbourne. It runs until the 4th of October. And we'll put details on our website as well as on that special event, which is called Classics in Conversation, for those in Melbourne or who are visiting the town of Melbourne, the city of Melbourne. This is Books and Arts Daily. Michael Cathcart with you. Next, a surprise meeting with a famous Aussie actor.
Look at this country. Purple skies. This sunburnt country. Wind that window down. Driving in your car. You can leave me anywhere you like. Songline dreaming in my heart. Satisfy what I feel. What I feel.
That's Open Road, performed by the Aboriginal actor and musician Tom E. Lewis. Tom's long and varied artistic career began back in the late 1970s when he was spotted by film director Fred Skepsey and his wife Rhonda at Melbourne's Tullamarine Airport. Now, they approached him and they asked him to audition for the lead role in their next film. And that film was The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith, a screen adaptation of Tom Kenneally's wonderful 1972 novel of the same name. It tells a very powerful story of a young Aboriginal man living in the 1890s, at the end of the 19th century, and of the racism and the violence that he faces at the hands of white settlers. It was one of the first Aboriginal films to tell a story from the perspective of an Aboriginal person, and it was the fourth Australian feature to compete at the Cannes Film Festival. Well, the other day, our producer, Georgia Moody, just happened to bump into Tom E. Lewis at the Melbourne airport, at the very place where his career was launched. There they were, both waiting in line to get their bags checked by security. And Georgia Moody thought, oh, that's Tom E. Lewis. Here's a microphone. Why didn't I interview him? She began by asking him about that moment when his artistic career began.
Sitting here at the airport at Tullamarines, I always have this beautiful memory. I got a beautiful memory here. It's like my sacred site. Do you think I could claim it? No, I'm wrong fella. I can't claim this place. Not my country here. Country's home in the territory. That's where I belong.
So, Tom, Take me back to 1977 when you were here at Tullamarine Airport in Melbourne. What happened that day?
Georgia, look out the window there. It was foggy, you couldn't see, and the planes couldn't move. And I was here on a yellow T-shirt and a green overall, warm boots, because I was cold. I'm looking at the billboard, cancelled, cancelled, cancelled. And next to me standing was this old scientist. He'd just come back from the Antarctica, and he's going to Darwin as well, and he still lives in Darwin today. I know Bob, the scientist. We were sitting down having a coffee like this, and over there was Rhonda Skepsi staring at me, that white lady staring at me. Next minute, her husband, a blonde guy, got up, and I've gone, what did I do wrong to these people, you know? And old Bob gone, you all right, Tom? And next minute, before I could answer, Rhonda was standing next to me. Hello, my name's Rhonda Skepsi, and we would like you to act in our movie. I'm going down, Mrs., you know. You gone a long time or you come back? 3 weeks I come back. Good, when you come here, give us a ring. Amazing learning time from then to now, you know. It's a very beautiful, fateful day. Something happened in my life.
The film you made with the Skepsis was The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith. What impact did that film have on your career?
On my career? I'm still Jimmy McGup. I'm still Jimmy today. No where I go. And it's been noted all around the country, around the world too, yeah.
I understand you're going to marry a white girl, Mr. Blacksmith.
You marry a white girl? Bad total.
You owe me, Mr. Newby, for 900 yards.
Listen, Jimmy. Don't you come to Bush Lawyer with me.
You must promise to stay away from those drunken rouseabouts.
I promise. You and Miss Neville have given me good education. Now I've got to start working so as I can get some property, get some money, so I can get married to a nice girl. Respectable.
A nice girl from a farm, of good stock. Then your children would be only quarter caste, and your grandchildren only one-eighth caste.
Scarcely black at all.
And after The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith, it was in Victoria that Tom's musical and theatrical career was also launched.
I'm painting a didgeridoo in a gallery in Warrandyte. One beautiful afternoon, this old white fella turned up and he goes, Tom, what are you doing? Old man, I got a paintbrush, some paint, and a didgeridoo in my hand. I think I'm painting a didgeridoo. And he said, who for? The teacher in Geelong. And he still didn't go away. And he said, why aren't you playing it? So I looked at him, stared at him, got that didgeridoo, I took it home, annoyed the dogs in Warrandyte, and a month later I got the circular breathing, and that very day, MTC rang me up, Melbourne Theatre Company, got a job for you, everything is sort of open, till I ended up doing all the jazz festivals in Europe with a duo called Lewis and Young, and wow, yeah. Then I really got sick from alcohol. I drink too much. Jazz festivals, you know? One day I sobered up and went back to the territory. And it was beautiful. I never thought I could put the grog down, yeah? But happy now. And since I put it down, I've done a lot of amazing stuff. Things you dream about doing. I used to dream about doing Othello. Didn't know much about Shakespeare, but now I love it. I've learned so many beautiful things in the art that I could use as medicine, and that's the privilege. If you look at this country for art, you don't get rich. A lot of us Aboriginal actors and artists have made a lot of people rich, filling up people's pocket. So I'm thinking of trying to produce films, you know, make money for ourselves and tell stories and create room for families to work in. Because I've learned from many people, I believe that you've got to handball things back to your community, and that's what I've been doing, you know, handballing and strengthening the young women that work for Jilpan Arts. I'm so happy to do Marka. It's really, it's a blessing, true. I didn't go to school. I learned from people, so therefore maybe people can learn from me and hand things back. And that's about it, Marika. Yeah.
Thanks, Tom.
You're welcome, Georgia.
Look at this country. Purple skies. This sunburnt country. Wind that window down. Driving in your car, you can leave me anywhere you like. Songline dreaming in my heart, satisfy what I feel, what I feel deep inside. Rainbow feeling in my heart slips away when it's dried in the heat again. Wind that window down, driving in your car, you can leave me anywhere you like. On an open road somewhere, where my heart would feel this dance. Come on, baby, take my hand.
Tom E. Lewis. Gosh, he's good, isn't he? Musician, actor, and artistic director of Gilpin Arts. A completely unscheduled conversation with our producer, Georgia Moody, who bumped into Tom at the very place where his artistic career was launched, the Melbourne Airport. That was back in the 1970s when he met the Skepsis right there. Fred Skepsi, who directed that movie, The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith, which made Tom E. Lewis a star. And there's a photo that Georgia snapped of Tom at Tullamarine up on our website. And if you're in Brisbane, you've got three more nights to see Tom star in The Shadow King, which is the reworking of King Lear, which he's done with Michael Cantor. King Lear presented as a sprawling, blood-soaked tale of two Indigenous families in Australia's north. That runs until the 13th of September as part of the Brisbane Festival. And there's a link to that as well on our website. I'm Michael Cathcart. This is Books and Arts Daily, where now it's time to venture beyond the vinyl frontier.
I've made a lot of promos. Sometimes it's better if a man's voice starts.
Look, we haven't got this studio for very long and we're meant to be walking out with a promo.
We can do
and
this.
All you're doing it looks
shh.
Like...
Shush. I'm just thinking. Coming in, 4, 3.
Me, Ricky and Tim. A radio show about a radio show. Sunday at 3. Here on RN.
This is AVT, a Vietnamese pop band from the late 1960s and early 70s, and that track goes by the fantastic name The Three Mothers-in-Law, and it's one of a whole bunch of records that were recently given to the ABC Sound Library. On the sad occasion of the cuts to Radio Australia and the Australia Network, there's an office just behind this studio that used to be bustling with people making radio programs for Asia and the region, and now that office is pretty much empty. It's a pretty sad place to walk into at the moment. The collection of Australian and Pacific Islander vinyl records stayed behind when all those people left the corporation, and they're from the heyday of vinyl production in the region. It's now part of the ABC Sound Library. So today we're journeying beyond the vinyl frontier to listen to the pop stars of the Asia Pacific, and our intrepid ABC Sound Librarians have been adding these records to the archives, and they join me now. Michael Munson, James Lee, thank you for coming back.
Good morning.
Hi, Michael.
So the three mothers-in-law.
Yeah, and it's good to know that the mother-in-law joke's a universal one, isn't it?
I mean, I'm not sure. Is it good or a cause for despair? Yeah.
Exactly. I don't know. There are plenty of mothers-in-laws out there who would disagree with me. But
let's bring them back. Let's hear this.
Yeah, let's bring them back. AVT, some sort of comic trio, a little bit like maybe Vietnam's kind of precursor to the Doug Anthony All-Stars or something.
Oh, that's
I'm not
a good
sure.
One.
Yeah, but they're very quirky.
Yeah. Yes, it all makes sense if you can see the record cover. So you've got three wacky guys.
Yes, yeah, very wacky. Really kind of hamming it up on that cover.
That's right.
Very, very comic, obviously.
In fact, it's not unlike the sort of wacky theatre of the 70s you might have seen in Sydney, Melbourne, Adelaide or Brisbane or Perth.
That's exactly right. Mm.
It was a universal thing along with the mother-in-law jokes.
We tried to find out some information about these guys. It's not easy. There's not.
No.
So we've been landed with this bunch of records, and even talking to the people that remain in RA.
There are five or six people left, lonely souls. Yeah.
They have trouble, you know, trying to work out what this stuff is.
Well, it just shows you all the knowledge that's walked out the door.
Yeah, yeah, very much so.
When Radio Australia
exactly.
Was,
but we think it's very, very cool, this stuff. A lot of really interesting sounds. And it's not stuff you're going to find out there on the web. And it deserves to be played. So,
yeah, we thought, let's bring it in. It's kind of refreshing, too, to just to pick up something like AVT and have absolutely no idea what it is, where it comes from. You can kind of put a few things together and figure things out. But it is good to, you know, come into something like that without any preconceptions.
It makes me want to see AVT, the sitcom. Mm. You know, there are three wacky Vietnamese guys who sing jokes about mothers-in-law.
Well, they actually put out quite a few records.
Yeah, they did. Prolific.
Prolific.
They were, because a lot of the stuff that's come to us is from the same labels.
Yeah.
But we have been able to sort of ascertain that AVT were quite big in their time, quite popular, because we have three or four discs by AVT in the collection. And
quite a lot of singles, 70 singles from the Vietnam.
So I'm holding this record in my hand. It's a 45, isn't it? Yeah, that smaller format. The size, if you don't know your records, this is the size of a bread and butter plate rather than the size of a dinner plate. And this one's bright orange.
Yeah, they're all beautiful, beautiful colours of the rainbow.
Yeah, yeah, they're magnificent pressings. And, you know, I've never seen a pressing like that before. I've seen coloured vinyl, of course, but nothing quite so fluorescent as that.
So if you thought records were black, think again.
Think again, that's right.
But there is an interesting confluence of, you know, Western, Eastern ideas in this lot that we have here.
Yeah.
The next one we're going to talk about is from Papua New Guinea, this group called the Stalemates. And likewise, not a lot of information we could find about them. Mm. Aside from that they probably played pubs in Port Moresby.
Well, hotels. They're from Port Moresby. And as was the common custom at the time, a lot of these bands would wind up playing in hotels, basically, I would imagine, for a tourist kind of group.
And a lot of Aussie groups toured. Is that right?
I'm not sure.
Well, Aussie groups toured the pubs up there. Well, I suppose it makes sense. And anyway, this is a cover of a well-known song. Why don't we just give the listeners a little quiz and see if you can remember or tell us who first recorded this song, which has been covered here by the Papua New Guinea group, the Stalemates.
Oh, Cecilia, you're breaking my heart. You're shaking my confidence daily.
The old Simon and Garfunkel.
Simon, yes.
Yeah, it's a ripper.
It was on Bridge Over Troubled Water. It was on the album 1970, I remember it well.
Interestingly enough, it's just been re-released by some British boy band.
Has it?
Yeah,
right now.
I just saw it.
What, as if it's a brand new shiny thing?
Yeah,
yeah.
Very much so. But the Stalemates were there for it many years ago.
But a great sounding recording, like the drums are flat and, you know, just not a lot of effects, nothing fancy.
They haven't quite got that throb in their voice, though. I mean, as I remember, the original Simon and Garfunkel was a kind of, oh, Cecile, and they kind of pleading.
But maybe that's a part of that, their cult.
More laid back, you say.
Yeah.
Okay.
Singapore. Let's go to Singapore. Yep. Another one from the RA collection.
Looking guy.
Yeah, Ling Xiao and the Melodians. Again, very hard to find out anything about Ling Xiao. But we have been able to sort of dig this one up. This is from his EP Blue Train, and this is the title track, Blue Train.
Blue Train.
赶到车站里，谁知道无情火车已经开走。
You were enjoying that, weren't you, Michael?
Yeah, Lynn Sauer, when too much reverb is never enough.
Exactly.
I know.
Kind of
maybe
spooky,
it was in the bathroom.
Yeah, spooky reverberated vocals, some psychedelic guitar, some great organ, which is quite possible he plays himself, I'm not sure.
So this is another 45, a little single, and there's a picture of him on the cover. He's a handsome dude, isn't he?
He is very handsome. A lot of, lot of
gorgeous,
product in that hair.
Yeah,
but on the back, there's also a lineup of people, young girls, young people waiting to listen to the record by the looks of it.
But he's quite almost the matinee idol, isn't he?
He's kind gorgeous.
He's fantastic. And again, quite a few discs by Ling Xiao in the collection that have come to us. So he was obviously, again, quite popular.
And quite a lot from Singapore. So Singapore seemed to be a little more liberal, probably, and, you know, you could get... there was that... what's the label? Tony. That he was pumping out huge amounts of pop.
Now, if you're a listener and you know more about these recording artists that we know so little about, we're just enjoying the sounds here, jump onto the website, jump onto the Books and Arts website, onto this story, and just tell us what you
know. That'd be great.
And if you can document it, tell us where you get this information from. That would be good, because people make all sorts of claims, of course. But if you can help us... You know, fill in the details of what this is, where all these come from. That'd be great.
This next one's a doozy. This is a soundtrack from a film called The Legends of Cheating. And it's by a very famous director, a Chinese director, Michael. Is that right? I think we've been able to establish that he's Chinese.
Li Han Hsiang.
So he had a very, very successful film career. Filming mainly in Hong Kong, as was the custom in this time, around the 60s and 70s. He made more than 70 films. Now, I've looked up it's on IMDb. The plot is apparently, of Legends of Cheating, is several interesting tales are told about the world of cheaters, as in, cheaters, and the tactics these con artists use to cheat unsuspecting people. Might have been slightly autobiographical for Lee, because the track we're about to hear is called Moon. It's called Moon. Bear that in mind as we listen to it. And it's written by the director himself. Let's have a listen.
This is like that segment on Spicks and Specks where they sing a song, but you're, singing the lyrics from the ABC editorial policy.
Exactly.
You've got 100.
So it's quite a well-known tune.
He's a long way from San Jose, isn't he?
That's right, yes.
But he is credited there as the sole composer of that particular
Bert,
track.
Bert doesn't get a mention.
Is that right?
Yeah, and nor does Hal David, obviously. But, so Lee Hsiang has written the lyrics.
He wouldn't get away with it today in the modern intellectual property environment.
He was a huge... He made over 70 films in his lifetime. He's a big name. He's probably the only one that we can actually find a lot about.
Yeah. He's very well known. A flagrant disregard for any copyright infringement, which is kind of refreshing to see.
Let's go for one more.
Yeah, okay. All right, well, what have we got here? We've got... Is this... Something off this
Barabara. Yeah,
Barabara. Chae Yin Hoon.
This is on what was the name of this label?
The stars of the label, which is Strong Wind.
Strong Wind label.
Yeah, so this is like an album sampler.
It doesn't translate very well.
No,
it's just a complaint.
Yeah, it's a condition.
That's right.
No, this is one of the great labels of. Are we in Singapore? Back in Singapore, I think.
Yes, we are.
We are. Yeah. And this is by Chae Yi Hong, and it's Bara Bara. My baby, Bara Bara.
Do you reckon that's a cover, or is it just such a standard rock and roll track that I'm not...
Yeah. Well, that's what we had the same problem with trying to pin it down.
Yeah.
There's an Italian song by Mina released in 1960 called Tintorella di Luna, which I think this is kind of based on. It's vague.
Very esoteric connection you're making there.
I know, and look, I could be wrong too, but as you say, it's just a very generic kind of westernised kind of thing, but very hot swinging sounds there from Singapore.
So how large is this collection that's come to us on this sad occasion?
Oh, look, it's not huge. I think they received quite a lot of albums in the day. These were obviously sent over to us from the region as they were kind of being pressed and distributed in the late 60s and early 70s. And it just seems to be that there was a kind of golden era there over the course of probably sort of, half a decade right. or so, I guess, where we accumulated quite a lot. But I don't know, Michael, it's not a huge...
No, it's not a huge collection.
...sprawling collection, no.
Stuff that's been, sitting at the back of
people's desks and so on.
Yeah, so it would have been kind of dispersed, but this is what remains and we have it's great.
Thank you so much for bringing it in.
Thank you.
As always, great to go beyond the vinyl frontier with you guys and find out what we've got in the sound archives. James Lee and Michael Munson, our ABC sound librarians. And if you have a final track on vinyl you think we should play, get in touch, tell us on the website. Or if you know any background to any of the recordings that we've been enjoying this afternoon or this morning it is, what am I saying? Do jump online and let us know. Now, yesterday I got a bit worked up about people who are finicky about pronunciation, and I asked the spouses of those people to write in and tell me how they managed to live with a pernickety husband or wife. And my plea elicited just three responses. It didn't really go off. Dita writes this, my wife is married to a pernicular person. She is a pure phlegmatic, nothing bothers her ever. That is how she copes. I love her even though she can't read maps or reverse a trailer. It has worked for the past 45 years. So that's an endorsement of a happy marriage. Michael writes, I have no spouse. I can't find one who will put up with me. I don't care how you pronounce anything, but I can't stand how people misuse the word decimate, which Michael insists means kill every 10th person. Which technically it does, and Michael would like that meaning to remain the sole meaning of the word decimate. And a regular correspondent, Tony, writes this, sorry, but I no longer have a spouse to offer you, not due to the cessation of her life, but because we are, each of us, obsessive, compulsive correctors of each other. And then he writes, ha ha, in a sort of evil laugh to wind up with. Thank you, Tony. Always nice to hear from you. Now, don't forget to get reading our September book in the European Classics Book Club. It's Crime and Punishment by Dostoevsky. It's a big one, so get stuck into that. And on our next show, you'll meet Karl Ove Knausgård, the Norwegian writer who writes about his own life with shocking honesty. The latest volume of his autobiography has just become available in English. That one's called Boyhood Island. And a good news story from Catherine in the Northern Territory, how this music is making life better for the people who live there. We're just coming up to the 3 a.m. news, and then it's Big Ideas. Tonight, how former enemies became friends. The former Irish president, Mary McAleese, talks about the Irish peace process. I'm Michael Cathcart. This is RN. Good night.
For me, Scotland has always been and always will be a different country. A country that had a different language, different legal system, a different educational system.
And different values. That's the important thing about our cultural identity. We have different values from England.
But will that be enough to make the Scots vote for independence? Join me, Keri Phillips, for Rear Vision and a grand experiment in democracy. Scotland and independence. Download or stream this Rear Vision from the RN website.